Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm joined today by Melvin Loeffler, professor emeritus of American history at the University of Virginia and one of the most foremost scholars of the Cold War, author of many books, including For the Soul of Mankind. Professor Loeffler, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And also with us today is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna. Hello, Professor Loeffler.
Hi, Jack. Very nice to meet you.
Well, today I've brought these two gentlemen together because we're going to take a close look at political language, how it flows through history, is oft repeated in our politics, and can determine policy, and most specifically, how, when it comes to the U.S.'s global posture, past can indeed be prologue, but only if we want it to. And we may be running into a case where we may not. So let's start with this. 1952, a Coronet Films production called Communism, meant for public schools across the country.
Looking at Russia, we might see it as a country to be studied. Yet we know that Russia today is regarded as a grave threat to our nation, to our freedom, to the peace of the world.
Same year, 1952, here's Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy at the Republican National Convention.
One communist on the faculty of one university is one communist too many. One communist among the American advisors at Yalta was one communist too many. Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
Joseph McCarthy in 1952. Now, Professor Loeffler, remind us, what was the tone, the language, the rhetoric that American leaders used when speaking to the American people about the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War?
I think those broadcasts that you just played are wonderfully illustrative of the rhetoric and language of the early Cold War. Basically, the language that was used communicated to the American people that we were locked in a Cold War in which both sides really denied the very legitimacy of the other. That's what the Cold War was about, that we were engaged in a dire existential struggle in which we denied the core values of our adversary and which we believed the adversary, meaning the Soviet Union, denied our own core values and quested to destroy, quote, our way of life. Frequently, policymakers like President Harry Truman, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, Dwight D. Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles, both Democrats and Republicans during the early decades of the Cold War, often engaged in rhetoric in which they alleged that the adversary was seeking to destroy our way of life. And in truth, the leaders of our adversary, leaders of the Soviet Union, often said things and engaged in language that communicated or was sometimes misinterpreted to mean an intention to destroy our way of life.
And that sort of constant repetition of the existential threat of the Soviet Union was repeated decade after decade. I mean, here is President Ronald Reagan in March of 1983 at a speech at the National Association of Evangelicals in Orlando, Florida. He opened that speech with a story about a man, a prominent entertainer, as he said, that he'd met a few years before. And here's the story that he told.
And suddenly, though, I heard him saying, "I love my little girls more than anything." And I said to myself, "Oh, no, don't. You can't. Don't say that." But I had underestimated him. He went on, "I would rather see my little girls die now, still believing in God, than have them grow up under communism and one day die no longer believing in God."
Jack Beatty, that was from 1983, and you still hear that strong tone of the moral, existential, spiritual threat that Reagan talked about the Soviet Union.
Yes, and in one of the great ironies of the Cold War is that we saw the Russians' communism, international communism, as a threat to our way of life, to our, as Professor Leffler says, our own core values. And in the course of the Cold War, we betrayed our own core values. We became what we abhorred. Early on, one of the charter documents of the Cold War, the X article in Foreign Affairs, 1947, George Kennan said, "The Soviet challenge requires only that Americans live up to their own best traditions." Well, you heard Senator McCarthy and the domestic paranoia about communism. That wasn't our best tradition. For half the period of the Cold War, racial segregation obtained in the American South, maintained by sporadic terrorism. And increasingly, the Cold War became an arms race. By 1989, at its end, we had military alliances with 50 countries stationed up to a million troops in 111 countries. There was this huge, and then in foreign policy, we toppled democratic governments in Guatemala, in Iran. We interfered in Chile. We, backed dictators hither and yon, betraying our own core values, even as we were asserting our moral superiority. We certainly were superior in one respect: hypocrisy.
Interesting. Well, so this is exactly why I wanted to talk with the two of you about this today, because that same assertion, or I'm hearing echoes of those Cold War era assertions in terms of in the way that American leaders and politicians are talking about modern day China now. For example,
"Now, I've spoken about this at some length. The People's Republic of China represent an absolute existential threat to our country."
Well, I think there needs to be a realization that China poses an existential threat to the West as a whole through the rest of this century.
"I believe China is the single greatest geopolitical threat facing the United States for the next century."
So that was former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in July at the Reagan Library, former National Security Advisor John Bolton in September of this year, Senator Ted Cruz in August of last year. There it is, that word existential, that phrase existential threat. Professor Leffler, do you hear echoes of Cold War era rhetoric in terms of how some leaders are talking about China now?
I certainly hear some echoes of the Cold War rhetoric, and those excerpts of speeches that you just played illustrate that. And in fact, during the presidential campaign, even Joe Biden engaged in that language from time to time. Although I should emphasize that since taking office, both he and his advisors, I think, have begun to shy away from that language. So the emphasis on China as an existential threat, I think, hugely overstates the situation. China is a significant economic, geopolitical, strategic, and ideological challenger to the United States. But Chinese leaders do not engage in rhetoric that suggests that they, quote, want to destroy our way of life. They don't use rhetoric like Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, once used, in which he gave a famous press conference in which he talked about, quote, burying the United States. We will bury you. He didn't, Nikita Khrushchev, when he spoke in that vein, did not mean that he was intent, or the Soviet Union was intent in engaging in a military struggle that would bury us, but he believed that the superiority of the communist system over the long run would triumph and bury the United States.
Well, Professor Loeffler, if I can just jump in here for a second, Khrushchev et al. May have not used that language, but I'm hearing in terms of how American leaders talk about China, they are, again, those same echoes. I mean, we even heard it on our own show a couple of weeks ago. We had a fantastic guest, Oriana Schuyler Mastro, a fellow at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies and also an Air Force reservist. And here's what she actually said about China.
The bottom line is that China has a different vision of what it wants the world to be like. And it's not only that China wants to control what governments do, they want to control what corporations, universities, individuals can say and do. The only thing that is stopping them from that level of influence, right, from being able to reach in, even to the United States, to punish people for saying or doing things China does not like, maybe freezing your bank accounts, maybe stopping your computer from working, maybe convincing Stanford not to give me tenure because they don't like what I have to say. You know, the only thing that stands in the way of China having that degree of power is the United States.
So that was Oriana Schuyler Mastro on our show on November 10th. Jack Beatty, we've got about 30 seconds before the break. You want to respond to that?
Oh, that's terrifying, isn't it? What a vision. They can get into our computers. They can counter us militarily. They can give us different values and so on. That is the China threat. And if you look up on JSTOR's, the journal that, you know, that collects scholarly articles, it is all over the China threat. And China counters it by saying, this evokes the yellow peril. This evokes this China threat, the racialism around the turn of the century about China. And they're seeing it in these terms.
Well, this hour, we are talking about what sounds like some familiar Cold War era rhetoric when it comes to how American politicians are talking about modern China today and the consequences of that. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at the language that American leaders are currently using when it comes to talking about China and whether there's an echo. There's an echo there in terms of how the United States used to talk about the Soviet Union during the Cold War and actually even also how it used to talk about China in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. He's with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Melvin Loeffler joins us as well, professor emeritus of American history at the University of Virginia, one of the foremost historians of the Cold War era. Let's listen to a couple of more pieces of tape in terms of how American presidents have talked about the Soviet Union and continue our analysis. We heard from some Republicans earlier. Well, here's President John F. Kennedy in 1961 in his inaugural address. Of course, at this point in time, the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union was truly actually an existential issue. And in his speech, President Kennedy made this pledge.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
So, Professor Loeffler, I mean, Kennedy doesn't explicitly name the Soviet Union there, but he didn't really have to. So can you talk a little bit about in the 60s how the U.S.'s position regarding the Soviet Union through, you know, its rhetorical position really informed some of the policies that Washington adopted?
Well, the rhetorical position even of John Kennedy changed dramatically. The rhetoric evolved during the 1960s. After all, the United States progressed from a policy of very hard confrontation called Eisenhower's policy was called massive retaliation and the new look to wage the Cold War. John Kennedy's speech that you just played, his inaugural address, communicated an enormous threat in which we were engaged globally. But keep in mind, if you played a quotation from John Kennedy's speech in May of 1963 at American University, you would have beautiful quotes illustrating America's desire and his desire to reassess our relationship with the Soviet Union, to find areas of common interest. Similarly, that wonderful speech you played by Ronald Reagan to the Conference of Evangelicals in 1983. Subsequently, he gave another speech in which he talked precisely about the common interests of the typical Russian family and the typical American family, and how typical workers in both countries simply wanted a better standard of living, and therefore we can find mutual interests with one another. The point of this is to say that during the early Cold War, during the period from roughly 1945 to 63, there was a perception of great threat. That evolves, and the perception of threat is still there, but it becomes much more modulated, and new policies emerge. So when one thinks about using the analogy or the rhetoric of the Cold War, I think we should be very alert to the fact that, in fact, we are not now in the same type of Cold War with China as the United States was with the Soviet Union from 1945 to 63. The circumstances are entirely different than they were at that time. And when we perceive the magnitude of threat and measure it carefully, we should be aware that using that rhetoric that you're referring to totally mischaracterizes the situation. And I'll be glad to elaborate upon that.
Yeah, so but this is exactly why I want to have this conversation, because your point is not only well taken, I think it's exactly right, Professor Loeffler. I mean, I'm looking at Kennedy's American University speech that you mentioned an historic address, right? And he says, he talks about peace, right? What kind of peace do I mean? What kind of peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. He says, I'm talking about a genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on Earth worth living. So yes, there was a profound evolution over time, and we'll come back to that later. But your warning about taking a step back from almost Manichaean rhetoric that we did hear at times during the Cold War and not repeating that regarding modern-day China, because it is not the same thing as the USSR, is exactly right. And yet, for example, in May of this year, here's what Senator Tommy Tuberville said, Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, on the Senate floor.
China actively seeks to outpace the United States military, and in some cases, they're succeeding. This isn't a 5 or 10 year problem. The threat is right now. It is no secret that the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP, wants to replace the U.S. as the world's top power. The American people need to be aware of how the Chinese Communist Party is coming after us, not just with missiles and military might, but with plans to subdue the American spirit.
That's Senator Tommy Tuberville in May of this year. And again, just to echo back to one of the most famous lines that President Reagan uttered in that speech to the National Association of Evangelicals in 1983, here's what he said.
To ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding, and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong and good and evil.
President Ronald Reagan in 1983, that evil empire line there. Jack Beatty, some lessons that you think we should learn when thinking about modern China, lessons we should learn from the Cold War.
A point made by Joe Nye that these extravagant statements, this massive, if you will, overkill, to use a weapon from a word from the Cold War, can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. if it's said often enough, if it's picked up often enough, it begins to set in store a kind of what Robert J. Lifton, the psychiatrist, calls psychic numbing. We grow numb to it. We just think, oh, it's China, they're our enemy. And we forget that we live. Our way of life, our consumer way of life, is made possible by cheap goods or goods that are inexpensive made in China, that they're our economic partner, that they complement our system. And all this gets lost in this fervid enemy talk. And of course, there is a deep vested interest driving it. You know, President Eisenhower, when he left office, warned of the military-industrial complex. But he really had another word in there, the military-industrial congressional complex. He dropped that at the last minute because that's what drives all this. Our defense spending in 2019 was $640 billion. What was China's? $261. Now, it doesn't look like a huge threat there, but what sustains this level of spending and the congressional, you know, largesse that they give out is this terror talk, is this threat talk, and Eisenhower warned then that it's that very arms racing can itself aggravate and indeed lead to war.
Professor Leffler, you want to respond?
Yes, no, I agree very much with what Jack is saying. And one of the things to keep in mind is that it is true that Chinese military expenditures are rapidly increasing. But as Jack just emphasized, they are still incomparably smaller than American military spending. As Jack said, the United States spends something close to $700 billion a year on military, and the Chinese, although rapidly increasing their expenditures, spend, you know, roughly $270, $280 $8 billion a year. Right now, we read even this week in the press that the Chinese are rapidly expanding their nuclear arsenal and contemplating the possibility of maybe tripling the nuclear arsenal of China or quadrupling it over the next decade. Well, China right now has roughly, we estimate, 260, 270 nuclear warheads. We have something in the vicinity of 6,000 nuclear warheads. Mm. So one needs to keep all of this in very close perspective. One needs to measure the nature of the threat. The great threat during the early Cold War, when the Cold War began, the great, great threat, the perception of threat, was based on the fear that the Soviet Union could take advantage of existing economic and social and military circumstances to gain control over the preponderant resources of all of Europe and much of Asia, that the Soviet Union would capitalize upon the popularity of communist parties in France and Italy, that the Soviet Union might lure Germany and Japan, which had just been defeated in war, into a Soviet orbit. The United States was greatly fearful about the overall distribution of power in the international system, mm-hmm. in which the Soviet Union could gain control of the vital industrial centers of Europe and Northeast Asia. Just compare that to today. When you think about the distribution of power, even just in Asia, today China is actually surrounded by a wealthy Japan, a robust nationalistic India, a revanchist Russia, a competitive, successful South Korea. Even in Asia, China has no possibility of gaining total control, preponderant control over its own neighborhood, let alone gaining control yes. over much of Europe and Asia, as was the great fear during the early years of the Cold War.
Well, exactly. Okay, exactly. Although, again, China is different. I'll pursue that deeper difference in a second. But then, given everything that you said, Professor Loeffler, it doesn't help when American politicians right now continue to say things like this. Here's Senator Ted Cruz on Face the Nation just last month.
I really hope our young men and women that they go over there and kick their commie asses. We need to win in the Olympics.
That was Senator Cruz talking about the 2022 Winter Olympics in China. So I guess I'm somewhat asking you to read the minds of current day American political leadership, Professor Loeffler. But why is it then? Can you draw any conclusion about why we are hearing this amped up sort of extremist rhetoric about China?
Well, I think in part it does represent the fact that China is a significant geopolitical and economic challenger. China has been very successful. So there are reasons, legitimate reasons, to be concerned about the relative growth of Chinese power. But to think that it represents an existential threat is totally to misconstrue the situation. So I think in part, senators like Cruz are inclined to focus on the menace of China rather than to focus on the problems and challenges inside the United States. Mm. And I think this is an absolutely critical point when you think about the Cold War and analogies and lessons extrapolated. The reason the United States won the Cold War more than any other was the fact that the United States and its democratic allies in Western Europe and Japan and elsewhere, those countries made the system of democratic capitalism, or in Europe, as it was often called, social democracy. Policymakers made the system function effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of World War II, when the Cold War first began to take shape, most people around the world were extraordinarily uncertain about whether democratic capitalism really could function. Democratic capitalism was blamed globally for two world wars and a Great Depression.
Right,
people
right.
around the globe were uncertain whether democratic capitalism could really work effectively.
Mm. Professor Loeffler, if I may, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I just have to because I have to step in here. And I'll come back to you here, Professor Loeffler, in a second. But I wanted to give Jack a chance to chime in here about the broader point regarding sort of what the United States had to prove in at the height and after, or as the Cold War waned as well. Jack, just pick up on what Professor Loeffler was saying.
Well, it you know, after a point, the Cold War really became about itself, didn't it? I mean, what was the cause of it? Well, let's see. Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe. Oh, that's bad. Yes, it is, but it was inevitable. The Soviets wanted a cordon sanitaire between them and a revanchist Germany. Was it the spying? Was it the nuclear competition that ignited the cold? Whatever it was all lost sight of, and it became about itself. And it was tied in with, as I say, these vested interests and the whole sellout of the defense budget. And at the end, in 1989, someone calculated, Larry Korb, I think he was the assistant deputy defense secretary, that the U.S. had spent $8 to $9 trillion fighting the Cold War. That had been the price. And at what cost to our domestic life? At what cost? Suppose it had been $5 trillion and the $3 trillion had been spent, as George Kennan said, perfecting our domestic institutions.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about how modern-day China is distinctly different than the Soviet Union and why those differences matter in terms of how the United States should be talking publicly about the kind of relationship it wants with Beijing. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why we're hearing increasingly heated rhetoric from some American political leaders who are talking about China, modern-day China, as an existential threat to the United States, and how that rhetoric echoes what we heard in this country during the Cold War, at the height of it, and then even as the Cold War started waning. And what lessons we ought to learn from the consequences of that kind of rhetoric. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. And Melvin Loeffler is with us as well. He's professor emeritus of American history at the University of Virginia, author of many, many books, including For the Soul of Mankind. Now, Professor Loeffler, you had talked earlier about how China, modern day China, is different than 40s and 50s, the 40s and 50s USSR. Point well taken. But I also want to just talk about what was happening a little later, namely in the mid 60s, and how the United States was talking about China at that time because of Vietnam. Because I think we're hearing a lot of similar things today. So here is a speech that President Johnson gave at Johns Hopkins University, the Peace Without Conquest speech, in April of 1965. And he talks about why the United States, in his view, must wage war in Vietnam.
The confused nature of this conflict cannot mask the fact that it is the new face of an old enemy. Over this war, and all Asia is another reality. The deepening shadow of communist China. The contest in Vietnam is part of a wider pattern of aggressive purposes.
And what did Johnson think that wider pattern was?
There are those who say that all our effort there will be futile, that China's power is such that it is bound to dominate all Southeast Asia. But there is no end to that argument until all of the nations of Asia are swallowed up.
Okay, so that was President Lyndon Baines Johnson in April of 1965. Fast forward to November 16th, 2021. Here's historian John Mearsheimer on the PBS NewsHour.
The fact is that the United States and China are destined to engage in a serious security competition, in effect, another Cold War for the foreseeable future. And the reason for that is very simple. China is bent on dominating Asia.
That was just 2 weeks ago. Historian John Mearsheimer on the PBS NewsHour. Well, joining us now is Yang Yang Chong. She's a postdoctoral fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, a frequent columnist on U.S.-China relations. Yang Yang Chong, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so just respond to what you just heard from those echoes between 1965 and John Mearsheimer just 2 weeks ago in 2021.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've known Professor Mearsheimer since I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago. I have great respect for his scholarship, but I do not agree with him. And it's interesting, since we are talking about language, how this language is used, that China is used as the subject. But China is a country. It cannot think and do. So who in China is bent on dominating Asia or other parts of the world? There may be certain people in different levels of Chinese government or punditry in society who may have these views. But are these the dominant views? Are these the only views? Can these views be changed? And can the power relations be changed? I feel that this kind of rhetoric really reflects a profound lack of intellectual curiosity, as well as a lack of moral imagination, that these fears and insecurities are all projected onto a faceless other, and the world is being collapsed into this kind of false binary. And so oneself can pretend to be both morally superior as well as innocent.
I feel like it was ever thus, though, right, Yang Yang? I mean, that is one of the, from my layperson's view, one of the hallmarks of sort of how world powers talk about other nations at the in moments of tension.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would like to also point out that similar rhetorics are also used by the Chinese government. And in terms of talking about U.S. or Western imperialism bent on subverting the Chinese system, bent on keeping China backwards. And these are the language that are used directed at a domestic audience in order to legitimize the Chinese government's way of governing, in order to enhance its own control within China and potentially also overseas.
Mm. Now, I want to just reflect back on something Professor Leffler said a few minutes ago, because I think it's very, very important. And I want to hear from all of you again on this. And what the professor said was, modern-day China, for many reasons, is obviously very different than the Soviet Union of the 40s and 50s. And what the professor said was, one of the key differences is that China today is surrounded by a very, a nationalistic and rapidly developing India. There's Japan, who definitely has deep self-interest in not seeing China project its power, especially militarily, et cetera. So it's surrounded in a different way than the Soviet Union was in the 40s and 50s, when the fear was essentially, as Professor Leffler says, the failure of democratic capitalism. But I wonder, though, China doesn't necessarily have to forcibly project its power. The fear is that the biggest difference today is that China actually has its economic tentacles all the way by our own invitation in the United States already. I mean, if you look at the economic power of China, the United States can be almost seen, let's talk about trade, as a vassal state to China. And that is the existential threat that not just Ted Cruz, but occasionally Joe Biden and people on both sides of the aisles here, aisle here in the United States, are talking about. What do you think about that?
It is interesting, right? Because, for example, earlier in the clips, you've shown like certain senators on the floor saying, commie China and this and that. But of course, though the Chinese ruling party is nominally communist, China is now an integral part of the global capitalist system, and the Chinese government itself is a major player in the global capitalist system. And if we think about this integration, a lot of the overseas influence and political pressure that the Chinese government exerts through its economic leverage really is not so much as China's weakening the democratic system, but this but behaviors from certain Chinese entities are exposing the pre-existing weaknesses in a lot of societies where there are companies that prioritize access to the Chinese market instead of standing up for principles of freedom and human rights, and how these global supply chains, including like the forced labor issue and in the Uyghur, among the Uyghur people in the northwestern region of Xinjiang. Mm. And so it's really systems of oppression, including state oppression, are all connected. Mm. And simply projecting them as all in one single country contained by a border is a profound misunderstanding.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a moment to how President Biden has been talking about China this year. Here is the president at the State Department in February.
We'll also take on directly the challenges posed by our prosperity, security, and democratic values by our most serious competitor, China. We'll confront China's economic abuses, counter its aggressive, coercive action to push back on China's attack on human rights, intellectual property, and global governance. But we are ready to work with Beijing when it's in America's interest to do so.
Professor Loeffler, do you hear President Biden there trying to sort of thread the needle a little bit?
Yes, I certainly do. And I think that the general thrust of what he is saying makes a lot of sense. What he is saying that is that the United States needs to recognize that China is an economic competitor, that China does constitute a challenger in the global distribution of power. But he is also saying at the same time that there are areas of mutual interest, of common interest. The way you framed the issue a little while ago suggested that China's economic expansion and global capitalism could constitute an existential threat. Actually, China's economic growth has helped to illustrate the economic interdependence of the world. We have benefited as well as has been hurt by Chinese economic growth. And President Biden is saying we need to be cognizant of the challenges, mm-hmm. but we also must struggle to identify common interests. And the United States and China have enormous common interests. When you think about what is the overriding threat to national security in the coming generation, it's really climate change and global warming and pandemics, terrorism, migration flows. On so many of the overriding national security issues, there are reasons for the United States and China to work together in pursuit of their mutual interests. And right. That's what President Biden is saying. Be aware of the challenge, but seek out interdependence and mutual interests.
Well, so, Professor Loeffler, the point you just made is exactly where I want us to round out the show here, because it really, what's called for is less of the bellicose rhetoric, less of the China presents an existential threat to the fact of Americanness, and more, say, of what we heard from President Gerald Ford in his State of the Union address in January of 1975.
Our relations with the communist countries are a basic factor of the world environment. We must seek to build a long-term basis for coexistence. We will stand by our principles. We will stand by our interests. We will act firmly when challenged. The kind of a world we want depends on a broad policy of creating mutual incentives for restraint and for cooperation.
President Ford, in January of 1975, the very next year, in an interview, President Ford said, "I think we have to talk about the realities. We ought to talk about trade. We ought to talk about science and those things in an atmosphere where we are dealing from strength and recognize that others may have some, but we have to have that strength to move ahead." So, Jack Beatty, you're the one who raised the very important point about the costs of all that extremely bellicose Cold War rhetoric, the existential rhetoric, the trillions of dollars that it did cost the United States. So what lessons would you draw from how by 1975 President Ford was talking about the U.S. versus communism and how we might apply those lessons regarding America and China today?
Well, he saw that what he called and what President Nixon called détente was in our interest, the weakening of tensions, the signing of arms control agreements, the bringing of that arms race under control. However, within a year or more, under pressure from the Republican primaries from Ronald Reagan, Mr. Ford told his CIA, which had submitted a report saying the Russians aren't such a threat. He came up with another team B of hawks, advisors to the Pentagon and so on, who said, "Oh my God, Russia is 10 feet tall. We have a huge problem." And that that team B report, which was done partly just to ward off threats from Reagan, became the basis for the trillion-dollar Reagan defense boom, which was the biggest peacetime expansion of U.S. defense spending ever. So even President Ford was sort of trapped in the imperatives of American domestic politics, in which anti-communism and anti-Sovietism and now anti-China it looks like the Trump card.
Mm. We only have 2 minutes left, and I want to be able to give an equal amount of time to Yang Ying Chong and Professor Loeffler. So, Professor Loeffler, I'll go to you first. Just a quick minute here. Your last words on this topic.
Yes,
today.
I was just going to say, but even President Reagan came to realize that the Soviet Union and the United States had mutual interests in curbing the strategic arms race, in negotiating arms limitation agreements, and most of all, in seeking to abolish nuclear weapons. Once again, Republican officials from Ford to Reagan, from Nixon, Ford, and Reagan, while waging the Cold War, also understood that they needed to seek out mutual interests. And that's what we need to do today.
Yeah. So Yang Ying Chong, last word goes to you. One lesson that I'm taking away from all of this is that regarding all that Cold War rhetoric and the evolution of the political mindset in this country, it took a period of many decades. That's simply a fact. Is there a way to accelerate that same process now so that Beijing and Washington don't have to go through a period of decades at odds and can instead, as Professor Loeffler said, try to find that mutual interest to the benefit of all nations much faster?
Yeah, so since we are talking about the Cold War, but the Cold War really was a hot war in many parts of the world. And it's like the people who exist on the edges of empires, on the margins of nationhood, who are bearing forefront the cost of it. And we are seeing these being played out again. And so I think one really important thing is to listen to the voices in the margins who are bearing the front of the cost in terms of xenophobic rhetoric, in terms of state oppression, in terms of climate change, and to be able to see the edge not as an end, but as a new beginning, and to imagine a world where humanity as a species can come together and imagine a future where no one is an exile.
Mm. Well, Yang Ying Chong, postdoctoral fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai Center and a frequent columnist on Chinese politics and U.S.-China relations, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Melvin Loeffler, Professor Emeritus of American History at the University of Virginia, whose new book coming out in 2023 is Confronting Saddam Hussein, George W. Bush, and the Invasion of Iraq. Professor Loeffler, thank you so very much.
Pleasure to speak with you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. It's always great to have you, Jack. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.